Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Year in Review. As today we talk about some of the key data sets presented in publications in the past year on immunotherapy and other non-targeted approach to lung cancer. We have a great faculty today, Dr. Luis Paz Ares, the head of the lung cancer unit at the National Oncology Research Center in Madrid, Spain. 10:30 at night there for Luis. We really appreciate him joining in. And then Dr. Heather Wakely, who's chief of the Division of Oncology and the deputy director of the Stanford Cancer Institute in Stanford, California. As always, if you have any questions or cases you'd like to run by us, just type them into the chat room. We'll talk about as many of those as we have time. As we do in all of our webinars, we're putting out a short one-minute quiz for you to take before and after the meeting. If you do that, we'll learn a little bit about you and you'll get a lot more out of this meeting. We know a lot of people end up listening to our webinars. If you're into podcasts, check out our Oncology Today series, including a recent program with Dr. Guerin on non-small cell lung cancer in patients without actionable mutations. We do webinars all the time. On April the 19th, we'll be doing another year in review program, this time on colorectal cancer. And then we're heading out to the Oncology Nursing Society meeting that we go to every year. We're actually putting on 10 symposium out there. We've got 40 faculty coming to San Antonio. We love going out there and meeting with the nurses every year. So anyone who wants those in the San Antonio area or going to ONS, come on, check it out. Or one will be, everything will be online, like 15 hours of content during that week. So check it out online. Right after, we're going from ONS actually to the AUA meeting, Urologic Oncology. We're doing two symposia there. Again, it'll also be broadcast online, one on bladder cancer on Sunday morning, April 30th, and then that same day in the evening, a program on prostate cancer. But today we're here to talk about lung cancer and particularly immunotherapy. In terms of where we're heading, I met, as we do with all of our year in review series, with each of the faculty, and we recorded a presentation and discussion of a whole bunch of papers that we're going to sort of refer to today. Those links are in the chat room. We'll also be sending out an email with links to these presentations. And optimally, you want to watch the presentations and then watch or listen to this webinar as we chat about, you know, some of the key themes that came out. Both of these faculty members covered quite a few papers. Heather focused on papers related to metastatic disease. Luis focused on papers related to local therapy and also papers related to small cell. And so we're going to kind of get to the top line of a number of themes that came out in their presentation. But before we sort of get started with what's new, I just want to take a step back. And Heather, you know, I was reflecting back on the fact we know about 30% of our audience has been in oncology less than 10 years. And actually, it's only 8 years ago that the first IO was approved in 2015, nivolumab in second-line therapy. And I can remember I was at the actually a GU symposium. There's a little internet thing on the internet of me talking and saying, right before that, it was in February, right before the approval came out, like, life is about to change in medical oncology, and your waiting rooms and your infusion rooms are going to be looking a lot different in the next couple of years. Any reflections back on this amazing, you know, of course, we've had targeted therapy also to deal with, but Heather, in terms of immunotherapy, a whole set of different toxicity issues to consider, just a completely new world. For people who are new in oncology, anything you want to say to reflect back on what it's been like to see this happen?
Well, I mean, it's been phenomenal. I remember in when I was a university student and medical student, you know, really thinking about if only we could get the immune system to work against cancer, but it was sort of a pipe dream at the time. And when I started, which is going to date myself, but when I started, we just had chemotherapy. It was right at the dawn of the targeted treatment and being able to think differently and recognize that cancers aren't all the same when they were lung cancer, and just throwing chemo isn't the right approach for a lot of patients. And with the immune therapy and the success, first with the PD-1 inhibitors, rapidly PD-L1 inhibitors, now so many of them, and of course now we've got CTLA-4 and others as well, it's really changed what we're able to do to help most patients. Now, unfortunately, we're still not helping everybody to the full extent that we would like to, but to have that as an option, it's really completely, it's a whole new paradigm. And so when I'm with a newly diagnosed patient, instead of just saying, well, we've got chemo or we're going to test and maybe you'll have a targetable mutation, it's we've got immune therapy and we're going to use that for almost everybody. And with that, and we'll go through some of the data later today, you know, there's a 20% chance that someone's going to be doing okay in 5 years. I mean, we never got to say that before. And so for those who weren't part of that change, it's sort of like, oh yes, well, of course we have immune therapy. But for those of us who have been doing this for a while longer, it's really phenomenal to reflect on the change.
Luis, any thoughts about this? We know a lot of fellows use our programs. I was just thinking about, we're about to go to AUA, and now the urologists, you know, now they're using IOs for non-muscle invasive. They have to kind of get their whole offices set up to do stuff like that. Any thoughts about what it's been like to see this happen, Luis?
I mean, that has been actually phenomenal. I remember some, a bit more than 10 years ago, when Dr. Topalian presented the phase one trial of Nivo at ASCO. Before going home, I bought a new book on immunology because I was not a believer. Honestly, this is not joking. That was totally true. I never thought I would use at all immunotherapy on my clinic. And then, you know, but after seeing 4 patients out of 8 third line patients, non-small cell lung cancer, responding on that trial, that was actually the second class of novel immunotherapeutics after ipilimumab. I thought, this is going to be something here. The only thing I have to say is that over the last 10 years, we have seen great things in lung cancer, but most of the novel discoveries were coming from, second line, first line, stage 3, and now early stage, but we haven't got many new things. And that is maybe the next thing we have to address. At the beginning, we thought, you know, we have many checkpoints. We are going to have a lot of different classes of agents. And, you know, that is turning a bit more difficult than we thought.
So, yeah, that's one of the things I think we'll get into. Have we hit a plateau here, or is there a lot more to go and a lot more excitement? Well, let's look at that in a minute as we go through these papers. So let's begin talking about metastatic disease and Heather's review of that. And First, a lot of these, we're starting to see long-term outcomes on a lot of these immunotherapy strategies. A number of the papers that you commented on, Heather, were related to long-term therapy. Can you just kind of put in perspective, I think we were talking about the fact that, you know, and now it looks like, particularly in high PD-1 patients, maybe 20% of people with metastatic disease will be without progression at 5 years. Any way to sort of pick out, you know, greater chance of that happening, less chance? Have we learned more about how to identify those patients? And also the issue of duration of therapy, Heather, how you're approaching that when you stop mm-hmm. therapy, and does it differ based on the response the patients had?
So great questions, lots of them there. As I was mentioning, when I have a newly diagnosed patient coming to see me in clinic, we talk about the fact that in order for me to choose the best treatment for them, I need to know more about their cancer. And the things I need to know are, what's the PD-L1 level? And I also need to know what might be the underlying driver mutation. And when you talk about, well, how do we pick who's going to respond most likely and who isn't, you really need both of those pieces of information, because we know that there are patients with an underlying driver mutation, such as ALK, where they're gonna have high PD-L1 levels, but the checkpoint inhibitors won't work. So you need to kind of have that full picture. Now, there will be patients who are too ill to wait for all the details, but we really would prefer to get all of that information before making that first line treatment decision. So here we're talking about those without the driver mutation, so I won't jump into that, though that's a large percentage of my patient population. But for those who don't have an underlying driver mutation that's actionable, the PD-L1 level does matter a lot from my perspective. It's not a perfect biomarker. It's not like having a driver mutation or not, but it does help to select. And we know in the metastatic setting, if a patient's tumor has PD-L1 expression that's high, and you know, we're using that 50% number, but it's, you know, it's not a precise cut point. They've got a good chance, more than half, of having a long-term benefit from being on a checkpoint inhibitor single agent. And whether that's going to be the pembrolizumab, or we've got first-line atezolizumab, we've got this data with cemiplimab, there are a lot of options. And a brief aside and point out what Louise said too, we're not as focusing on innovation as we could be, because we're looking at a lot of same trial. So I'll come off of that soapbox, but we do need to be thinking about what we can do better as opposed to replicating. But to be able to replicate with so many drugs that a patient whose tumor has high PD-L1 can go on a single agent drug, immune therapy, and have a 20% chance of long-term, whether we call it cure or not, I think we still debate. You were asking about duration of treatment. And when we're designing trials, we come up with numbers about how long to treat. And a lot of it is done, honestly, somewhat blindly. So there was a 2-year choice for a lot of the single agent checkpoint inhibitors. There's very little data checking on that. There was a long ago trial with nivolumab looking at a shorter duration versus longer. And in that particular trial, the patients who had the longer duration did better than those who stopped, I think it was like at 6 months. But we haven't really questioned the what about beyond 2 years, or who might be able to stop sooner. And I think those are some of the novel trials we do need to be looking at in the future, perhaps with circulating tumor DNA or other liquid biomarkers to see who's had a really great response and maybe they don't have any cancer left, and who is just kind of holding on. And as soon as you stop the treatment, they'll progress. We know that those groups exist. We just don't know how to find them yet. We also know that now that we've had these longer term follow-ups, if you stop at 2 years, maybe half the patients never have their cancer show up again, or at least for as long as we've been tracking. But the other half do, and that can be after a year, or it can be relatively soon. And so these are where we need to be innovative in how we figure out who's who and who's going to do well in the long run and who isn't. And that's a pretty exciting place to be, to be able to ask those sorts of questions.
So nowadays when I do webinars, I wait and see, like, at what time is somebody going to bring up ctDNA? So this time it took 11 minutes. Usually that's about right. Luisa, what are your thoughts about a duration? Does it matter whether the patient has a partial or complete response? Any thoughts about ctDNA? Also, clinically, you know, over the year, these last few years, there's been a lot of discussion about when do you need to add chemo. But how are you approaching the issue of whether or not to use monotherapy? One of the issues is if you have a symptomatic patient, you think the patient really can't afford to progress. I hear a lot of people saying, I think about that. Also, do you approach people differently if their PD-1's 50% versus, say, 90 or 95%, Louis?
Okay. So I would say that, as Heather said, PD-L1 is not perfect, but it gives quite a lot of information. Let's say the higher the PD-L1 expression, the higher the likelihood of benefiting, and the higher the magnitude of the benefit. So let's say if you're 90%, it's going to be, you know, most of my patients that are 90% PD-L1 will receive monotherapy. On the other hand, if my patient is 50% and had some other adverse event, if adverse feature, let's say the patient is very symptomatic, or the patient is having no smoking history, even, I don't know, is having any genomic abnormality that is amenable for a specific therapy. You know, if the patient is having aggressive disease, I may tend not to give monotherapy, you know, alone. With monotherapy, single agent, 30 to 40% of the patients progress in 3 months. And that is a risk you really have to take into account. If your patient may allow a progression and is still having a second chance. So if my patient is very symptomatic, or you feel he needs a quick response, maybe I would prefer to go chemo-IO, but I would say 2/3 to 3/4 of my high PD-L1 patients will go for monotherapy.
So we did a webinar last night with Sarah Hurvitz from UCLA on breast cancer, and we were getting these incredible cases in the chat room. I was saying how great our chat room is. So Heather, here's one from Dr. Kumar, who's a Florida cancer specialist doc. I think you've been to some of our programs we've had with that group. He has a patient who had three brain mets and a pathologic fracture of the hip. Brain mets treated with surgery and cyber knife. The patient's now 5 years on an IO, and the question is, would you continue it? His PD-1 originally was 95%.
Wow, that is a tough case. I think that, you know, it's been 5 years. This is the type of situation where I don't think we have the ctDNA assays yet that are commercially available that would be able to help you, but I think we're heading in that direction. This is the type of case where I'd probably get a PET scan just to make sure there's nothing lurking that we're not really aware of, giving you know, the test that we do have, and then have that discussion with the patient about potentially stopping and watching closely. You know, the only pause, of course, is that we do know from the limited data that we have from the trials that if a patient who is in the situation does stop and is one of that plus or minus 50% who does recur, not all of them regain the response, right? And that's the part that makes us all a bit nervous about stopping. At the same time, 5 years, 95%, if there's nothing that looks active on scans anywhere, I'd probably take the risk and stop. But it would be a long conversation with the patient.
So, yeah, always great to allow the patient to get involved. And again, thinking back 8 years ago, can you imagine presenting a case with three brain mets and a pathologic fracture that 5 years later we'd be saying, should we stop therapy or not? I mean, really amazing. I see also, too, one of the other papers you covered was looking at sub-Q IO, and this was with Atezo. But, Luis, any thoughts about that? We see that, you know, for example, anti-CD38 antibodies in myeloma now going all sub-Q. It seems like it has a great practical impact. Is that kind of the way you see things going, Luis?
Absolutely. And, you know, I mean, we have done that with, let's say, rituximab in the past, you know, and I feel it's great. Our day hospitals are becoming really busy. It's really a pain for patients to be there for really 2 years, coming on and on to have their shot of immunotherapy. So if you're able to do really a quick subcutaneous injection, that is going to be great. So I'm really a believer of that.
So and here are a couple more papers on chemo immunotherapy that Heather covered. And we're going to talk about a whole bunch of trials that are actually coming out starting in the next few weeks. And one of the issues here, Heather, is there are more and more IOs or anti-PD-1, anti-PD-L1. At this point, any way to differentiate them from your point of view? Are these basically me too drugs?
You had to ask me that question, Neil. I think they all are a little bit different. And when we look across trials, you know, we've had outcomes that didn't make sense with almost every drug in at least some setting. And, you know, that speaks to the fact that when you do trials, you don't always know what you're going to come up with. I think structurally, you know, there's subtle differences. You know, we tend to end up going with wherever the first one gets to a particular indication, and then we stick with that because we become creatures of habit. I think where there'll be differences in the future is if there come cost differences or, you know, the subcutaneous formulations, things that make it easier for patients. But for now, it's hard to say clearly that one is better than another in a different setting. We just, even though we've had some trials that have given us variable outcomes, I'll say. So I'm not really answering your question because it's not one that's so easy to answer. I mean, I think I do tend to use pembrolizumab in the first line in combination with chemotherapy when I'm going to be doing that. That's just because that's what I've gotten used to. I mean, the data with cemiplimab certainly looks as good. So that's encouraging. Starting to think more about, and this will be our next group of slides, the CTLA-4 combinations with PD-1, PD-L1. And then you've got fewer options because there have been fewer combination trials with those. But it's tough. And I do worry, and I think Luis hinted at this as well, that we do have a number of Me Too studies, which are not looking at it from the how do we really take a leap forward in helping patients to more of like, how do I make sure my drug is one of the ones that people are using? So, and those are somewhat different questions.
So Lewis, Heather referred to IO-CTLA-4 combinations, and she presented a bunch of studies, including now we have data with durvalumab, tremelimumab, a combination also with some really interesting findings with hepatocellular cancer. It sounded like Heather is starting to get more interested and convinced about this strategy, particularly with low PD-1 level patients. Lewis, what are your thoughts about this strategy? What are the situations where right now you think it's reasonable to think about it? And any difference in your mind between Ipi-Nivo and Durva-Tremi?
So, you know, there is somehow a point here about being or not a believer of CTLA-4 inhibition in lung cancer. I'm actually a bit of a believer of the combination of the dual immunotherapy with PD-1 and CTLA-4 inhibition. The actual data on the 227 trial with Ipi-Nivo, the long-term data are really, I would say, the 5 years data are pretty good, particularly, I would say, for the, as you said, for some subset of patients, those with squamous histology or those with negative PD-L1 expression. And the 9LA regime, which is very much the same Ipi-Nivo combo plus two chemotherapy courses to start with. I think this second strategy have proven to be good in terms of reducing the risk of early progression. The question is that we do not have yet so mature data to say the quality of the responses due to the chemotherapy is the same as the responses due to immunotherapy. So how are going to be the long-term data? Are those going to be any better as compared to Ipi-Nivo alone? We don't know as yet, but the data are at least quite validating the fact that for squamous patients and for those with low PD-L1 expression, the results are pretty good. Nicely, the Durva-Treme Poseidon trial show also some significant improvement. I have to say here that most of the benefit has been seen on non-squamous histology, which is not validating the same concept with the same approach. And I think we have to be somehow cautious here because, you know, when you see things are not matching. On the other hand, at present, you know, I've been using more Ipi-Nivo as compared to Durva-Treme, and I don't think they have been compared one to each other. And it's the only thing I can say about the combination, right?
So, Heather, before you comment in terms of correlation, we'll save this for later, but Hassan in the chat room wants to know, why is there such a strong correlation with PD-1 positivity and efficacy in the advanced disease setting, and you didn't see it, at least with Pembro, in the adjuvant setting, but we'll get to that in a second. Heather, what about these What about these combinations right now in your practice? Is there a clinical situation, PD-1 zero or whatever, where you might want to do this or you are doing it? And what specific combination you think is optimal?
So the emerging data, and I'm not going to answer your last question, but I'm going to think about it a little bit. I think that where we see themes across trials, I think we're more likely seeing a truth. And when we saw the first data where maybe nivolumab, ipilimumab worked when there was no PD-L1 expression, I'm like, oh, that's interesting. But now that we've seen it, not just with that combination, but also the durvalumab, tremelimumab, now I think maybe that is likely a truth. And so when I have a patient who does not have PD-L1 expression on their tumor, I've started using the nivolumab, ipilimumab. I'm sure durvalumab, tremelimumab is also a reasonable option. It's just that's kind of, again, what we knew about first. And so it's what we're more comfortable, what I'm more comfortable using.
So let's talk about antibody-drug conjugates. Now, you all, in terms of targeted therapy and immunotherapy, have really led the way in oncology, but there's already a lot going on with antibody-drug conjugates. Looks like now you're starting to get more into it, so to speak. Heather, in your talk, you went through a couple really exciting agents. And again, if you think about it right now in oncology, there are two antibody-drug conjugates approved in bladder cancer. It's used first-line in Hodgkin. Maybe it's going to be in diffuse large B-cell, cervical cancer, ovarian cancer, antibody-drug conjugates. What about datopotamab deruxtecan? Of course, the last name, so to speak, of deruxtecan we're already familiar with TDXD. Mm-hmm. We'll talk about that and her two mutations and when we get to targeted therapy. But what about this agent targeting Heather, and what we know about it and sort of where it's heading with this idea? Again, we just saw in bladder cancer an approval, first-line antibody-drug conjugate plus pembro and fortimab, and we're looking at the same strategy being tested on lung cancer. What about dato-TDXD, Heather?
So the antibody-drug conjugates in the sort of non-targeted, somewhat targeted, it's a little bit, I'll say I'm still a little bit of a skeptic. I'm a big believer in the setting of like the trastuzumab deruxtecan, as you mentioned, where we have, there's HER2 mutation, you've got a drug that targeted, beautiful responses. I mean, really phenomenal. And with the others where you've got targets like TROP2, where we're talking about the CEACAM1, and there's some others where it's a bit more of a broader target. And, you know, some of them, and we have a lot of studies of drugs where the response rate's around 20%. Now, this one's better than that in this data, so I don't want to sound too negative, but I think I'm just trying to make sure we're not focusing too much on fancy chemo, but something where you really are getting an advantage by having that target that you're going after. And so when we look at this data that Ben Levy presented, it was very encouraging because the response rates were quite high. And we'll get to that on the next. But what they looked at doing was taking this drug, antibody-drug conjugate, TROP2, and then was this deruxtecan component to it, which has been a very good payload, shall we say, in a lot of the different drugs that we've seen before. And they looked at a combination of the drug with pembrolizumab, but or the drug plus a platinum doublet, or platinum chemotherapy, because it's already a chemotherapy, plus pembrolizumab. And what was interesting was the triplet wasn't better than the doublet. And the response rates were actually quite good, especially when you looked into first line, and encouraging enough to move forward. And so we're looking at this data here showing that response rates were, you know, greater than 50% when we're looking at first line. When we look at all comers, it's still in the 30%+ range. So it's not that 20% we've seen in some of the other settings. So that's encouraging. And I think it supports they're going to move into big phase three. We do need to be cautious. And as you mentioned, a lot of folks who are listening to this and watching this haven't been in oncology for quite as long or as Luis and you and I have all been. And so it's important to always remember, we can see amazing phase two data that doesn't pan out in phase three. We've had many randomized phase two trials where we thought, this is it, this drug's going to change everything, and then it got to phase three and it didn't work. So I think we always need to follow up with the phase three unless we're in the very, very targeted situation. So for most other things, these are really critical. And so I think that the data so far supports this exciting trial where they are looking at just the two drug regimen. So this new antibody drug conjugate plus pembrolizumab versus pembrolizumab in patients who have high PD-L1 expressing lung cancer. So exciting. And I was pretty, when Ben presented this data, I was like, oh, okay, I'm going to be less of a skeptic about ADCs now. And I'm excited to see this move forward.
I can always depend on you to question everything. I know you were questioning Adora for a long time. I don't know if you feel better now they have a survival benefit. But anyhow, Luisa, the other issue is the other thing is, you know, dato as a single agent in second line versus docetaxel. You know, maybe that's where it's going to start out. We were talking about sacituzumab. Same thing. Mm-hmm. You know, it's chat room. They're asking about TROP2 expression, which kind of doesn't seem to be playing out. But Luis, any thoughts about Dato and where it's heading?
Well, I think I quite agree with Heather in the fact that, you know, for those 86, there are two situations that are different. One is when you're using the target as a hook, only as a hook. And the other situation is when the hook is also an important biological target, when it's a driver. In this second situation is the ideal situation because you're getting really good responses. So it's really kind of a targeted ADC. On the other situation, maybe better than docetaxel, among other reasons, because docetaxel is not a great drug for second, third line, you know. So it's maybe better, but, you know, this is going to be like a small improvement, some addition for our patients, a new alternative, but it's not going to be long-lasting for most of the cases. The only thing is that, again, we should learn a bit on the payload and biomarkers related to the payload. We are really, you know, let's say in many of those cases, we didn't see difference between high expression or low expression of the target, let's say TROP2 or whatever. So maybe having biomarkers related to the payload is going to be important into the future when we will have 10 different, let's say, ADCs for a given clinical scenario.
Yeah, I think docetaxel is like the chlorambucil of lung cancer. Everybody wants to beat it up, but not too many people have, actually. What about this other antibody-drug conjugate, Heather? I'm just going to say TUSA. I don't know if other people use that. It's a little tricky to pronounce, but can you explain like what it is and how it relates to CEA, how it works?
Sure. So this is the tisamitamab revtansin. So different payload, and that's important when we think about toxicity. But we won't talk so much about that today. And CEACAM5, so CEA, cell adhesion molecule 5, and it is one that has a little bit of variable expression in tumors, as opposed to the antibody drug conjugates where you've got a payload, which is the hook, as Luis was saying, or not the payload, but you've got the antibody hits the hook, brings in the payload, but the level of that doesn't seem to matter very much. This one, the level does matter, and you see that with higher CEACAM levels, there seems to be a higher correlation with response. There was some data updated at ASCO 2022 where they were looking at their long-term responders. And what they did show was that for patients who did respond, the response tended to be pretty durable. And I think that's encouraging. You know, we tend to focus with new drugs just on response. But if everybody responds, but only for like a month, that's not very good, right? You need to have drugs that lead to durable responses to have the true meaningful impact for our patients. And so I think that's what's encouraging about this compound. And they've nicely shown that if you have higher rates of response, you have a higher probability of response, though, yeah, the response rates are still not fantastic, right? You're helping a small number of patients, maybe, you know, it's 20%, a little bit higher when you're dealing with, you know, stable disease. So, and if you have stable disease that goes on for a long time, it's in some ways better than a response at short duration. So like I will look at long-term stability as a good thing in patients who have otherwise progressing disease. So encouraging, I think it's still early. And it's certainly a compound worth following. And I think they've got some big trials ongoing, so we'll be seeing more about this.
So, Luis, any thoughts about this ADC? And also want to ask you about this other study that Heather commented on in her talk, the Hudson trial, where, you know, it's a multiple biomarker. I don't know if you call it a basket trial or not, but, you know, based on biomarkers, they use various combinations. I'm curious about that type of research, Luis. You know, I think it was called the Battle Trial that Roy Herbst started many years ago at MD Anderson. Kind of, this is like the grandchild of the Battle study to me. Any thoughts about this type of research, Luis? And also any other comments about the CEACAM's ADC?
So, I mean, looking to the CEACAM5 ADCs. I think CEACAM5 is a target that is going to be used with a number of ADCs, having also not only an antimicrotubular payload, such as the trial here discussed, but in some other cases with the other payloads, with topo one poisons and so on. Indeed, there are even now trials already presented with combinations with platinum, with with pembrolizumab, or even quadruplets with ADC, platinum, pembrolizumab plus the pembrolizumab, with nice responses in early trials, of course. And I think we have to see how good they are in the long term. Secondly, I mean, concerning those platform trials, I think it's the way to go. You know, I mean, the battle trial was really good, the idea. However, we didn't have good drugs to target different subset of patients. The good thing now is that we know a bit more on the biology, on potential targets, and also we got more drugs. So we are having more possibilities to do platform trials and having different drugs for different subset of patients. And this is a good example. The nice thing here is actually in that very trial, the combination of durvalumab plus an ATR inhibitor, in that case, teralasertib, is actually better as compared to any other combination. And, you know, we are now maybe in the times that we should think on targeted immunotherapy, so where not every single patient is going to receive the same immunotherapy, but different combinations of immunotherapy. And this is maybe a good example. So into the future, some patients may be better treated with durvalumab plus this ATR inhibitor. And in fact, I think there are already plans, not only with this ATR, but also with others for further development in lung cancer.
So they're pretty good numbers in trials. I mean, if you look at them in like phase two, I mean, 189 patients with these other regimens. All right, Tumor Treating Fields. Again, we were talking about this as the SGO meeting. We're talking about the need for new strategies, Heather. We talked a little bit about this B36 study, and you know, the mechanism of action here, obviously very, very different from the therapies that we have available now. The way the therapy is delivered in terms of the device that the patients wear, also very much different. It's approved and used in GBM and mesothelioma, particularly in GBM, really interesting outcomes now, standard of care. You can see over on the right, I think down on the bottom there, like an ovarian type approach, as well as up there in the chest. These are the data, you know, a pretty good hazard rate in GBM. It's hard to argue with that. But we're starting to see things coming out in lung cancer. This was a phase 1-2 study looking at this in combination with pemetrexed. And I guess the data that was seen there was encouraging enough to consider putting it into a phase 3 trial. And here we go again. I was pretty surprised when I saw this one a couple of months ago. The LUNAR phase 3 study, adding Tumor Treating Fields. Added to Tumor Treating Fields is apparently in this phase 3 trial, adding it to either IOs or docetaxel is a positive study. I don't know exactly when we're going to see this, but Heather, you know, usually when we bring this up, I remember when we were at the Society of Neuro-Oncology many years ago, we first brought this up and people were like, what? But, you know, at least it's different and innovative. Any thoughts, Heather?
Well, I mean, obviously, we need to see the full data to know what is a statistically significant and clinically meaningful improvement, because that can be a lot of different things. But I the data in GBM is real, and it is a therapy that's used quite a bit. I mean, the biology of it makes sense. You're disrupting cells dividing, altering that mitosis, and so it does make sense. So the question is, how are those fields penetrating to all of the sites of disease? I think that's the one thing that we grapple with a little bit when we're dealing with a widely metastatic cancer versus a GBM, where you've got a bit more of a contained space. But I'm open to seeing what this looks like. I think that the discussions with patients, since I only treat thoracic cancers and I don't have a big mesothelioma practice, so I haven't had any personal experience with this so far. But I'm very excited to see what the data looks like. And as Luis and I were talking about at the beginning, you know, this is novel. This is going about things from a different strategy standpoint. And I think that we should be welcoming of that. I think that the toxicity profile, of course, is very different. And you've got a way that, like, what is it? What is the hassle factor of wearing this? But then you don't have some of the other toxicities we get with our systemic therapy. So it might be a reasonable trade-off. And I think that is something we need to continue to talk about. And I think encourage companies and investigators to go out there and try novel approaches, because we do make a difference. So I'm excited to see the data. I don't know anything about any of the results yet other than this. So.
Well, I like the fact that they're talking about survival, because you can't argue with that. You know, sometimes PFS gets a little tricky, but survival is survival. So it should be interesting. And in terms of toxicity, I mean, at SGO, we had a couple of patients presented. There were issues with dermatologic toxicity, but I think they're trying to work on it to maybe improve that. And again, docetaxel is no walk in the park either. I'm not sure from a patient acceptance point of view. Luis, any thoughts about this?
Well, I think I agree. You know, I mean, it's exciting to see that something totally different. Indeed, maybe most of us are not experts on the way those TTF fields are actually working, how this is able to control the growth of the tumor. But what is true is that it's a totally different mechanism of action, and I'm really looking forward to see the data, because it's the best way to be convinced about any novel approach. See the data, and you see particularly survival. So we'll see what happens.
So, you know, speaking about not being experts, we were talking about when IOs came into lung cancer. You know, prior to that, we had IOs in melanoma. But, you know, that's melanoma is not like lung cancer, because once we knew it was coming to lung cancer, okay, we're going to have to, everybody's going to have to know about it. So, you know, this is a lung cancer trial, so if people buy into it, I think there are going to be a lot of people becoming expert and using it, but to be continued. Okay, localized disease. Last night on the webinar, I was really getting people pumped up to hear what the two of you have to say about this, because this is a total area of confusion to me. So Luisa went through the data, and of course, we looked at both neoadjuvant and adjuvant trials. But I guess here's the graphic that I like, Luis, which sort of puts in perspective a bunch of trials. So here, first, let's talk about neoadjuvant therapy. You have the CheckMate 816 trial with Nivo, already, you know, approved and being used. I'm going to ask you about how you're approaching it. But we also have two press releases about the top trial there on the top, Keynote 671, and I'll show you the press release in the second, and the Aegean trial. So that's with Pembro, Aegean, a very similar design to CheckMate, but it's got adjuvant therapy, where CheckMate did not. And then Heather just told me as we were getting ready to start here that the one there over on the right, the teriplimab study, is also about to get presented at the ASCO virtual meeting in the next couple of weeks. So seems like we're going to have three new data sets available here, Luis. Where are we today right now, or where are you today about using neoadjuvant therapy? We'll get to adjuvant in a second, but in terms of neoadjuvant therapy, what's your take on it? Where are you using it right now? And where do you think we're going to be in the next few months after we see these three new studies?
Well, I think the situation right now is that we know immunotherapy is working in early stage. We know that it's working in the adjuvant setting. I think we know it's working in the neoadjuvant setting before surgery. Some data suggest in a preclinical models, but also in one clinical trial in melanoma, that maybe neoadjuvant could be better as compared to adjuvant. And this is make a lot of sense, because to get the immune system to work, you need some tumor antigens to be presented to the T cells, and you need some lymph nodes. where the antigen presentation may happen. And therefore, you may imagine that if you start immunotherapy before the tumor and the lymph nodes are resected, maybe it's a good idea. So knowing that this is working, the question is now, should we use neoadjuvant? Should we use adjuvant immunotherapy, or should we use both of them? So as today we know neoadjuvant is working and adjuvant is working, we don't know if having neoadjuvant plus adjuvant is going to be any better. So that is the reason we are really looking forward to see those three trials, the KEYNOTE-C71, the AEGEAN, but also the NeoTORCH trial, to see at least by indirect comparison how better are they as compared to, for example, the CheckMate-816. Still, you know, I think there are some patients that are likely to be more better benefited by neoadjuvant treatment. Let's say a patient with N2 disease, stage 3 disease. Maybe most of us would prefer to use chemo-IO beforehand. On the contrary, if we have a patient with stage 1, we may go better to a surgery, and then we will decide if this patient is worthy or not, depending on PD-L1 expression and other things, if this patient is a good candidate for adjuvant immunotherapy. So let's say we are at the beginning here, and I think we have to see how those data are maturing, and particularly I would really looking forward to see the initial data, the IGN data, to be presented at the ACR and maybe in the ASCO meeting, the trial with toripalimab, and maybe the KEYNOTE-671 trial in some coming meetings as well.
I can't wait to hear how you're going to deal with the issue should you give post-op adjuvant therapy. But Heather, any thoughts about this? You know, the idea of, you know, giving neoadjuvant therapy to resectable disease has been out there in breast cancer for a long time with HER2 and triple negative disease. And there now in HER2, they have a strategy that they know that works, that when you have residual disease in surgery, you give them a different drug, actually TDM1, an antibody drug conjugate. Any thoughts about whether that's where we're going to land in general? Where do you think the issue of neoadjuvant adjuvant is going to land over the next few years, Heather?
Great question. I seem to get asked to have to debate that at many conferences, so it's one that's a hot topic. I look at it from the perspective of, if you know the patient is definitely going to need immune therapy and chemotherapy, giving it up front makes a lot of sense. So with the stage 3 patient, most of them were now thinking about doing the neoadjuvant treatment approach. And of course, right now it's CheckMate 816, but we have these three trials where we have press releases and know that things are coming out shortly. And so I think that's going to, there could be a whole lot of data to try to process. Of course, we shouldn't do cross-trial comparisons, but we're going to try to. And as we do that, we need to be mindful. And, you know, this goes back in time to when we were trying to figure out about adjuvant versus neoadjuvant chemotherapy. You know, you can't look at the patient population who's going into a new adjuvant trial and compare them to a patient population going into an adjuvant trial, because they're different. Because an adjuvant trial only enrolls patients who already had their surgery and are well enough afterwards to get treatment. And a neoadjuvant, you've got patients enrolling, some of whom never make it to the surgery, but they, you know, it's different groups. And so trying to ask the question of how much does adjuvant add to neoadjuvant, we don't have a trial that's asking that question. Just showed a whole bunch of trials, but getting to our earlier theme, they're mostly asking the same question. Does our drug plus chemo before surgery followed by our drug after surgery better than not having our drug, as opposed to across the drugs, or looking at if we give it before, do we need it afterwards or not? So we've got opportunities to do additional studies. And then I'm gonna bring up ctDNA again, because I'm at Stanford and I work with Max Dean, right? We're actually doing a trial where patients who have had treatment and gone to surgery get ctDNA analysis, and if they're negative, we watch them, and if they're positive, they go on to get additional checkpoint inhibitor therapy. And I think those are the things we need to look at. And when I talk about this topic, I really look at it from the perspective of, we want to give every patient an opportunity to be cured, but we don't want to over-treat. And when you give neoadjuvant, you're treating everybody, and you don't have a chance to see who maybe didn't need the treatment. When you give adjuvant, you have an opportunity to ask that question. So for stage three, you know they pretty much need it, so might as well give it to them. But for earlier stages, maybe we have a chance to see who doesn't need it. And then I'm going to jump on the question we had before about PD-L1. Again, you look at a lot of trials to get to truth. So far, CheckMate 816, PD-L1 levels actually mattered quite a bit if you look in the details. IMpower010, it mattered quite a bit. The PEARLS trial, KEYNOTE-091, PD-L1 didn't track. But everything about pembrolizumab and metastatic disease tracks very closely to PD-L1. And so, you know, every trial is a truth in and of itself, right? If you get to the statistical significance, but you have to kind of put it all in context. So
speaking about IMpower010 and the PEARLS KEYNOTE-091, Luis, you reviewed that in your talk. Could you give us the bottom line, and also our chat room question related to what Heather just said is, why didn't you see a benefit in PEARLS with high PD-1?
Okay, so the way I see the result is, the main objective of both trials, they have similar results. They validate one to each other. You're reducing the risk of relapse, of progression, about 30%. And that is the key message. It is true that on the PEARLS trial, the benefit was not related to PD-L1 expression. That was a surprise, because in every other setting with pembrolizumab in monotherapy, you see a correlation between benefit and PD-L1 expression. So it's likely to be somehow an outlier. We have analyzed those data to see if there were some imbalance. We didn't find it. What is true is that we saw on this very trial that those patients treated on the placebo arm, among the high expressors, they were overperforming, as what was expected. But anyway, we have to analyze not only what happened in one single trial. I think biological plausibility is very important. All along the different disease stages, we have seen that PD-L1 expression matters, particularly when you're treating with immunotherapy a single agent. Maybe for chemo-IO is not quite the same, but for single agent, for sure, is clear, and the IMpower data are aligned with that hypothesis. So I'm really looking forward to see the data on the nivolumab and on the durvalumab adjuvant trials to see how PD-L1 expression is affecting the results. But for the time being, I would say more likely the higher the PD-L1 expression, the higher the benefit.
So I'll just ask a real simple question to Heather. Assuming you had access to either one of these agents, would you have any preference to use either one in any situation, particularly low PD-1?
Oh, you mean if I had a patient who had been through a complete surgical resection and I was trying to determine what drug to give them in the adjuvant setting? You've got me and Luis here, the primary presenter for IMpower010 and the primary presenter for the KEYNOTE-091. Oh, okay. I do think that the PD-L1 level is important, and I think that we're more likely to help people who have high PD-L1 levels, despite the data that came out. I think that and trying to choose between them, I mean, as Luis mentioned, I think when you look at the overall hazard ratio from both of the trials, it's actually quite similar. The difference being able to select or not. When we get into these discussions, we often focus on the efficacy without thinking about the toxicity. And we do need to focus on toxicity as well. With the checkpoint inhibitors, we can give people lifelong toxicity, especially, endocrinopathies are the most common that we see in that setting. And so trying to weigh, what is the probability I'm actually going to help this patient versus that probability I'm going to cause harm. That's really always the main question. I think at this point in the United States, we have both atezolizumab approved and we have pembrolizumab approved. If I have a patient who has low PD-L1 expression, I'm going to be pretty hesitant to give them treatment with either drug. And if they're high, I'll feel comfortable with either drug. I know that's not what the FDA has slated based on, you know, the statistics of how the trials were designed, but that's honestly how I'm thinking about it. And I'm going to come back and throw the ctDNA comment again. And because I think, you know, that's, again, our trial that we're doing at Stanford with durvalumab actually is for patients who have residual ctDNA. We start them on durvalumab and we see, do they have a response? To help us determine if that's meaningful or not. That's trial setting. So
I think it's going to be audience very important as well.
No, sorry. I was just going to say, I saw you shaking your head yes the entire time that she was talking. So it's, I think you maybe agree and does reflect what you were saying in our session we had. I'm going to just finish out with a couple other thoughts or from you. One of the other issues that you talked about, Lewis, was locally advanced disease. You know, talking about IOs changing things and also talking about following the data. You had the data with Durva, you don't have with Pembro, you're using Durva. So just reflecting back, first of all, on the basic trial, and you talked about some other studies looking at how this is playing out in the real world, et cetera. But any global comments, Luis, about this step forward that we've made now with, you know, really prolonged survival benefit that's now really completely gotten into the community setting? Any thoughts in kind of putting this in perspective in terms of what this trial really has meant to this field?
Yeah, I think this trial, I mean, it's great to have now really long-term follow-up on the PACIFIC trial. That had changed a lot, the outcome for patients with stage 3 disease. This is a substantial number of patients that are not candidates for surgery. And we know now that in the long term, in the at 5 years, survival is actually improved from 33% to 43%. More importantly, survival without progression is improving from 19% to 33%, nearly doubling. That is amazing. So most of those cases are going to be really cures, or it's very likely that those patients are representing cure. So I think this is very important. The second message is that, real world data somehow validate that. PACIFIC CIS is also telling us that if you're not candidate for chemo radiation concurrently, if you do that sequentially, you're still benefiting from durvalumab. And finally, you know, there are a number of ways to try to further improve the PACIFIC regime by doing that concurrently or by using some more, let's say, intensified immunotherapy, using combinations with durvalumab. And I think the COAST trial is a step forward on that direction.
And Heather, I was just flashing on, I remember meeting with you right after you presented the EMPOWER-010 study, you know, the initial data. And I remember one of the things you told me was one of the things you found most encouraging was the PACIFIC data in terms of how positive was your hope that maybe that same scenario was going to play out in the adjuvant setting, which it seems like it is at this point. Any thoughts, though, about COAST and other ways, you know, have new agents adding in, but also the idea that's being tested using the IO during chemo radiation. Any thoughts about new directions, Heather?
Well, I think that we do need to be thinking about what more we can do, because as much as it's so exciting to talk about these 5-year survival outcomes and longer and, you know, really thinking about maybe we are curing people, it's still the minority. And we have a lot more patients that we need to be able to do more for. And the only way we get there is by doing the trials and having these designs where you can look at a lot of different things in a relatively short period and do a little bit of a, maybe this is going to be better than that, let's move in that direction to help us move forward more quickly. I think that's really, really critical. So I'm encouraged by that. And the combination chemo, radiation, and immune therapy data, it's a, maybe better. It's definitely still a bit of caution. And I think when we are talking about adjuvant as well, I think that giving the sequential approach, which most of the trials have done, chemo followed by IO, is probably not as good as together. Just like in neoadjuvant, everything is combined, chemo, IO. And these are, again, more of the questions of the future. Who doesn't need immune therapy? Who doesn't need chemotherapy? Who maybe doesn't need radiation? Who might not need surgery? Like, you know, we've got all of these different variables, and right now we're still doing that. Everybody gets as much as possible because we're not curing enough people yet to feel comfortable pulling back, but that's where we need to be heading.
So we just have a couple minutes here. I want to bring up one thing, and we're talking about Louise covered new developments in small cell. Speaking of anti-CTLA-4, PD-1, Durva plus Tremi from ESMO, looking at that strategy. But what I really wanted to ask you about, because I was really shocked when I found out about this, is there's a bispecific in lung cancer, not amivantanib, but like the same kind of bispecifics we've been talking about in myeloma. I'm not exactly the same, but the same concept, myeloma, lymphoma, the DDL33 targeted bispecifics, and using, you know, the same immunologic approach to lung cancer in small cell. Luis, to me, this is incredibly exciting. We've been waiting for that, CAR T, everything else that we've been hearing about in hematologic oncology. Interesting that maybe it's going to be a small cell where we're starting to see that. Any thoughts about where this might be heading, Luis? Am I getting too excited?
No. I mean, I shared your excitement, to be honest. I think this is a bite that for the first time we see this novel approach of activating T cells on a different way, not through the canonical activation by binding the antigen to the TCR. Here is like a direct activation of the T cell, and we are getting for the first time a result in a solid tumor that is really attractive. Some 23% of here of our patients that were relapsing patients, many of them were actually in third line. And the nice thing was the safety profile was reasonable. There were some cytokine release syndrome in half of the patients, but typically grade 1 or 2, only one patient grade 3. There was just one patient that died due to the drug on that very cohort of 607 patients, and responses were seen in 23% of the cases. More importantly, the survival in this cohort of patients was exceeding 13 months. And, you know, if you go to every single trial with lung cancer, small cell lung cancer, with any drug, regardless, you're getting responses in 20-30% of the cases. Typically, median OS is 8 months. So I think there is a clear signal here. I'm really a believer of that. Still, we have to see, if possible, some more robust data.
So by the time this gets to lung cancer, oncologists will all be familiar with CRS and, you know, from myeloma, teclistamab already approved, and mosunetuzumab approved in lung cancer. They'll be ready for you if and when you get there. Heather, Luis, thank you so much for joining us tonight. Audience, thank you for joining us. Come on back next week. We'll talk about ctDNA. Come on back next week. We'll be talking about a lot of ctDNA and a lot of other things in colorectal cancer. Be safe, stay well, and have a great night. Thanks so much, Heather. Thanks, Luis.
Thank you.
Thank you.